Muffin Talk. Spirituality Center presents Muffin Talk with Beate.
Kia ora and welcome to our Muffin Talk. Muffin Talk is brought to you by the Mercy Spirituality Center in Ipsum. We are a center for retreats, spiritual guidance, Christian meditation, and personal development. Once a week, I invite a visitor to join me in the studio to talk about our center, our programs, the Mercy World, the Catholic Church, social justice, and ecumenism. Today, my visitor is Claire Amos. Claire, a warm welcome to our radio program.
Thank you.
Dr. Claire Amos is recently retired from her position as Program Coordinator for Interreligious Dialogue and Cooperation at the World Council of Churches in Geneva, where she has worked for the last 6 years. She is an Anglican, and she received a Lambeth Doctorate in Divinity and an Honorary Doctorate in the United States in recognition of her long-term contributions to ecumenical engagement, interreligious relations, and theological education. Claire's background is a Bible scholar and a teacher, and in her past she lived in the Middle East for about 10 years, both in Jerusalem and in Lebanon, where she studied and taught the Bible. Claire is from the United Kingdom and is currently visiting Auckland. Claire, this is only an abbreviated version of your curriculum vitae. Do you remember how your interest in the Bible, the Holy Land, and the Church started?
Well, I think it's, if I think about it, it's because I really love stories, and the Bible has got some really, really good stories in. Even as a small child, I loved sort of interesting stories. And then as I grew up, I got interested in things like history and things that were exotic. You know, I think I got attracted to the Middle East even, you know, as a young teenager. And then I went and I spent 3 months in Israel before I went to university. And although I'd say that my political views have now changed from the views I had then, I'm still fascinated by the Holy Land, and in a sense reading through the Bible through the lens of the Holy Land has always been very important to me.
So you connected the history and the stories,
yes,
to the place where they started.
Yeah. Yeah, and my first professional job, actually, I was incredibly lucky. I was to lead courses in the Holy Land for people who came from many parts of the world, you know. So I sort of was paid to do what I love to do.
Well, that's great. And I understand that you've currently undertaken a new challenge. You're writing a book about the Transfiguration.
Yes.
This will be a book only for Christians, or do you think that it will also help other religions to understand our belief better?
Well, I mean, inevitably, if I'm talking about the Transfiguration, I'm talking about something that occurs in the New Testament. So the primary focus is Christian. But there's a wonderful saying by John O'Donohue, who has written about spirituality, I think a book called Amankara. He talks about spirituality as the art of transfiguration. And I think that's a wonderful idea. And I think that at that point, transfiguration becomes, in a sense, more important for engaging with other religions too. I'm trying to do some work at this precise moment on the whole question of religion, violence, and peace building. And one of the things that I'm coming to the awareness of is the fact that transfiguration as a sort of mode of being in which you allow yourself to be influenced by the other and changed by it, and then actually the change in you affects others. I think this is a really important sort of tool and way of understanding to overcome things like the misuse of religion for violent purposes.
And it will be also, when you say with the different religions and different focus points, it will. You need to have an open mind.
You need to have an open mind, yes. I once helped write a report for the Anglican Communion on interfaith relations, and it was titled Generous Love. And I think one of the things that you need to bear in mind if you're involved in interfaith is the sense of the generosity of God.
Yeah. For those of you who've just tuned in, you're listening to Muffin Talk with Beate. This program is brought to you by the Mercy Spirituality Center in Ipsum. If you miss any of our programs, please check out www.planetaudio.org.nz/muffintalk or visit our website or Facebook page at Tengaka Waiora Mercy Spirituality Center. My visitor today is Dr. Claire Amos, an Anglican Bible scholar who has been committed in ecumenism and interreligious dialogue for many years. Claire, the other day you gave a presentation on the women in the gospel. You mentioned that we are looking at the role of the women in the gospel, but we had to start at the end. Can you explain why we had to start in the end?
Well, we're in the post-Easter season, so you need to start with the resurrection. And one of the things about women in the gospel is that all the gospels make clear the important role that women had as witnesses to the resurrection of Jesus. All of them. They name them as slightly differently, but it's a consistent feature in all four gospels. And you could say that without women to share the news to begin with, where would the church be today? Mary Magdalene, for example, was actually called the apostle to the apostles, and I think that's a wonderful name for her.
So do you think that the men would not have proclaimed the good news after the resurrection?
Well, it's interesting to reflect. I mean, the women were the first witnesses to the resurrection. That's certainly that. I mean, and it was because they were doing womenish things that they were there. They were the ones who were who'd got up early in the morning to do the anointing of Jesus's body that they didn't find in the end. But you know, it wasn't the men that were about to go and do that. And it was women who were showing their love and their care by their action that were, I think, worthy to be first witnesses of the resurrection.
So that's why we have to start with the women.
Why we started, so to speak, at the end, yes.
And then, of course, the women like stories, as you like stories, and
I like stories.
And when I think of the Old Testament, I can think of many women and their names, Sarah, Ruth, Esther, Judith, Rebecca, etc. But when I think of the Gospels, I can spontaneously only think of names of Mary, Martha, and Elizabeth. There are more, but it seems like the women in the Gospel, they're in the Gospels, always have the same name, or are they not named?
Well, actually, Mary was a very common name in the New Testament period. I mean, there's evidence that about a quarter of the women, Jewish women, were named Mary. So it's not surprising that we get Mary of different kinds of Mary. Mary, the mother of Jesus, Mary Magdalene, Mary, wife of Cleopas, several times. But there was rather a convention also, I think, and there still is, of course, in the Middle East today, that women get named in their relationship to their husband or to their son. So when I got married to my husband and we were living in Lebanon, I mean, there were people who, I'm sure, who thought of me as the wife of Alan rather than Claire. And I was fortunate that I didn't give birth to a son when I was in the Middle East. Otherwise, I would have been known forever as Robin rather than Claire. So there is a sense, I think, also that women were seen in relation to others rather than given their own name. But it's interesting, there are one or two cases where the later church gives the name to a woman that is nameless in the gospel itself. For example, the Samaritan woman that Jesus met at the well, she's not named in the Gospel of John, but in later sort of church stories and history, she's called Fatini, the one who's been enlightened, illuminated.
Yeah. I was just wondering, because when you talk about that story, the women at the well and Fatini, because I looked for the name of the women of the well and I found it only in Orthodox sources. And then I was wondering, is it because she was at bright daylight at the well, or was it because she was enlightened?
I think it was because she was seen as being enlightened. But it's an interesting idea, the bright daylight one, because, yes, you're right, it's the middle of the day that she meets Jesus. And, I mean, the fact that she is getting water at the middle of the day is often seen as being a sign that she wasn't very popular in her town, in her village, because you normally went and got water early in the morning. And perhaps it was because she wasn't, you know, she was shunned by the other women of the village, that she was having to get the water later in the day. So it's kind of rather nice that somebody who was seen as an outsider by her own people, is the one that has this enormously important role in the story.
Was that a region where the Samaritans used to live, or was it because when you say she was not accepted by the society, was she not accepted because of her life or because of being a Samaritan?
The assumption is that the whole town or village was Samaritan, but the reason she was perhaps on the outside was because the story has it she has been married 5 times, and Jesus says to her, "And he whom you now have is not your husband." So in a sense, she have probably offended the moral code of some people. But it was interesting, years ago I'd always assumed that she'd as it were changed husbands, you know, got rid of one and changed another, but actually it's interesting. An African friend of mine was saying that in Africa, It wasn't that she divorced her husbands, no, that they'd actually died, and she was seen as unlucky because of that. You know, so it's quite telling that we sometimes moralise her in a way that I think isn't necessarily appropriate or correct. That she might have been, yes, she might have had 5 husbands, but that's because one after the other, you know, in a days in which, well, people did die early, they died, and she was seen, sadly for her, as unlucky.
But that means that you really have to look at the historic context.
Sure.
Always.
And sure.
Because then I also heard an interpretation that she was seen as the Samaritan people who had different leaders, whereas the Israelites were always having one God and didn't have to abide to a leader in that way.
I think the stories that, particularly in the Gospel of John, work at several levels. They tell us a story about people, but underneath there's a lot of symbolism, and some of what you're saying, I'm sure, is accurate, that she is somehow seen as personifying the Samaritan people. And if you go back to parts of the Old Testament, and you have to remember that the Old Testament is largely written from people who weren't Samaritans, it's largely written by people who are against Samaritans, they saw the Samaritans as being unfaithful. So they almost portray the Samaritans as an unfaithful wife.
But that's interesting, because if they were against Samaritans, they could have even replaced the people, Samaritans. They would have said something else.
Well, one of the things that's interesting is that given the hostility in the New Testament period between Jews and Samaritans, it's interesting that this really important story in John's Gospel is set in Samaria, is so focused on Samaritans. It begins with the little comment, it was necessary for Jesus to go through Samaria, because he wanted to get up to Galilee from Jerusalem. It was necessary for him to go through Samaria. And yeah, is that just a geographical reference? Samaria was the easiest way to get from Jerusalem to Galilee. But I don't think so in the Gospel of John. I think it's more than that. I think John is saying that the whole nature of the ministry of Jesus is about extending God's love and breaking down boundaries and hatred.
And he went to women. Women were the witnesses. And she, as you say, a woman as the first apostle of the apostles.
Yes, yes. That's
right. I was just thinking, because recently we had that new movie about Mary Magdalene, which depicted her in a very different way to what the tradition used to tell us. So you, as a Bible scholar, how do you see Mary Magdalene?
Well, I haven't yet got to see the film, and I'm looking forward to doing that. But one of the things that's interesting about Mary Magdalene is that she's one of the very few women around who isn't described in terms of her husband or a son. Does that mean, first of all, that she was single? And what does it mean that she was called Mary Magdalene? Well, the village of Magdala was quite a significant, important village on the shores of the Sea of Galilee, a kind of fishing port. So it probably was saying that she came from Magdala. But the word Magdal, from which you get the name Magdala, means a tower, a sort of fortress. And there are those who suggest, and it goes back a long way, even to St. Jerome, that actually calling her Mary Magdalene was saying, Mary, the fortress, the tower, the strong woman, as it were. And it's nice to think of that.
So you have the symbolism again with it. And what do you, when you think of Mary Magdalene or the misunderstandings, how did that come?
Well, I think one thing is that Christian tradition, the Christian church, hasn't always found what I would call feisty women easy to deal with, and they like to kind of put them in their place. And it's slightly unfortunate that just before the first time that Mary Magdalene is mentioned in Luke's Gospel, there's a story about a woman who is a repentant prostitute, who's not named, by the way, who washes the feet of Jesus as a kind of act of repentance. And it's been rather convenient for Christian tradition to link the woman who does this, washes the feet of Jesus, as a gesture of repentance, with Mary Magdalene, who's referred to a few verses further on. But that's kind of sometimes how the church has behaved through the centuries. I think we're changing now, I'm glad to say. But still, sort of guilt, particularly about issues about things like sex, tend to get loaded on women rather a lot.
But then again, we're talking about the context. So when you think of the history of our church, it is also the history of the culture at that time.
Yes.
And so feisty women were maybe not accepted nowhere in majority of the countries.
I think what you see in the New Testament is a sense of a feeling of kind of liberation for women in some of the Gospels, particularly perhaps Mark and John. But that the later documents of the New Testament are already trying to sort of press down once again on women and say, you know, we can't let them get too much above themselves. They'll mess things up. They're a bit chaotic, you know. They're against nice order and things like that.
And I remember during your talk, you said, you quoted somebody, I can't remember who it was, he said, the whole of the gospel is encapsulated in Matthew's genealogy. Can you explain that to us?
Yes, well, the person who said it originally was the bishop, Anglican bishop, who confirmed me years and years and years ago. And the reason he was saying it is because on the surface, Matthew's genealogy, the birth, as it were, of Jesus, giving his ancestors, which comes at the beginning of Matthew's Gospel, looks very structured and ordered. But then you find, if you look carefully, that there are four women mentioned in it. Mostly it's just a list of the fathers, of the fathers, of the fathers, but there are these four women who are mentioned in the genealogy. And they are Tamar and Rahab and Ruth and Bathsheba, the wife of Uriah. And there are two things about these women that they have in common. First of all, they're all almost certainly seen as Gentiles, non-Jews. And so the fact that these four women are the ancestors of Jesus is, if you like, a sign of the openness of Jesus' ministry beyond the borders of Judaism. But the other thing is, there are also women who had, shall we say, a slightly ambiguous history in terms of male-female relations. Tamar had to save herself, actually, by seducing her father-in-law. Ruth, if you read the story of the Book of Ruth carefully, she certainly took the initiative in her relationship with Boaz. Rahab was described as a harlot in the Old Testament, and Bathsheba, the wife of Uriah, well, she was the classic, David was an adulterer and she was an adulteress. So it's interesting that it's women who have this, shall we say, certain sense of frisson about them that are the ancestors of Jesus. And in that sense, of course, as Matthew's Gospel suggests to us, although in Christian tradition we do believe in the virgin birth of Jesus from Mary, it's clear in Matthew's Gospel that actually that in itself potentially could cause a bit of scandal. You get the reference to Joseph talking about putting her aside carefully and quietly because he was concerned that she was found to be with child before they were married.
And that it's amazing that it's still the King David is still one of the main families in the in the Old Testament.
Sure.
Maybe it shows that everybody in the Bible is just human.
I think, yes, I think it's important to realize that the Bible does give us some human characters. And David is perhaps cherished partly because of his humanity, as well as the other things that he did.
And the women in the church, in the Anglican church, they have different positions than in the Catholic church. Maybe you can say a couple of words about how women are working as ministers.
Yes. Well, here in New Zealand and in many other parts of the Anglican world, but they're not all parts of the Anglican world, women can be deacons and priests, and in quite a lot of countries they can also be bishops. It would still be true to say that in most countries that women are a minority as priests, less so perhaps now here in New Zealand, because you've had women priests for nearly getting on for over 40 years at any rate. But certainly women have a recognised role in the ordained ministry of the church. And that is now, I think, in the provinces that have got women, that is seen as not just acceptable, it is seen as something to celebrate, it is seen as something to reflect the fact that when God created human beings, he created them in the image of God as male and female.
And what about other countries? Because the Anglican Church is also present in other continents.
Well, Papua New Guinea, for example, where there is quite a strong Anglican Church, doesn't have women priests. Actually, that's because the Anglican Church in Papua New Guinea, partly it's because the Anglican Church in Papua New Guinea is very high church. It's very close to the Roman Catholic. So I think if you went to an Anglican service in Papua New Guinea, you'd probably not be able to distinguish it very easily from the Roman Catholics. So they don't have women priests. I think there's one woman priest in the Solomon Islands, what's called Melanesia. But she was ordained actually back in England, not in the Solomon Islands, though she is a native of the Solomon Islands. In Nigeria there are no women priests. Again, it's partly a matter of culture, it's partly a matter in Nigeria of the church's evangelical tradition and the view that is suggested in 1 Corinthians. There's Paul talks about women not being allowed to talk in church, and that kind of thing is taken very seriously. So there are some provinces where women can't be ordained. Oh, Southeast Asia is another one. So Singapore, Malaysia, Borneo, Indonesia, women can't be ordained there.
It's more traditional there.
It's seen, but that's partly tradition, and it's partly, I think, the evangelical thrust of the church and wanting to say we need to follow the Bible in this respect.
Yeah. And a last question: can you tell us just a few impressions of your trips to the Holy Land? Because you've been there several times. You mentioned earlier that you spend some weeks there before you even started to study. But you go there regularly, don't you?
Yes, I do. And I'm very privileged that I do. And each time I do, I sort of feel sad and also moved at the same time. I was there, in fact, in January this year, with my husband, because it was our 40th wedding anniversary, and we'd met in Jerusalem, so we went back to Jerusalem for our 40th wedding anniversary. And of course, it was just a couple of weeks after the announcement about Trump moving the US embassy to Jerusalem. It hadn't happened then, but it was announced. And that had caused a lot of unhappiness, a sense of almost really people losing hope and despairing in East Jerusalem. And somebody said to us, a Palestinian shopkeeper we met said to us, a city without love is like a city without water. It's an extraordinarily powerful sort of image, because particularly in the Middle East, of course, cities need water desperately. And to talk about Jerusalem as a city without love, it's like a city without water, said something about the sadness, I think, of Jerusalem. For me, Jerusalem, there's an old Jewish proverb about Jerusalem. 10 parts of beauty gave God to the world, 9 to Jerusalem and 1 to the remainder. 10 parts of sorrow gave God to the world, 9 to Jerusalem and 1 to the remainder. Now, that might be a slight exaggeration about the beauty, but I love Jerusalem. I think it is a beautiful city. But what it's powerfully saying is that the beauty and people's longing and love for Jerusalem is deeply intermingled with the fact that there's been struggle and pain and fighting and conflict and tragedy there over centuries, actually, over millennia, you could say.
And it's a holy city for so many religions.
And it's a holy city for 3 religions, yes. And it's one of the things that the WCC, World Council of Churches, that I work for, feels strongly, is that Jerusalem needs to be a city that honours the fact that it is a holy city for 3 religions, and ways need to be found to acknowledge the right of Jews, of Christians and of Muslims to be able to look after their holy places and to visit them.
Yeah. Thank you very much, Claire.
Thank you.
Thank you for sharing some of your experience with us. And I'm sure that we can continue for a long time because you're full of knowledge. And I'm very interested in what you have to say about the women in the Gospels. And
thank you. It's been a privilege to be with you this morning.
Thank you. And to our listeners, what is coming up in our Mercy Spirituality Center? Today, on the 15th, and then on the 22nd of June, we'll have Susan Healy, who is going to give a presentation on the treaty and the connectedness for the many cultures of Aotearoa, New Zealand. Friday, 15th, on the 22nd of June, from 7 to 9 p.m. And on Sunday, the 24th of June, we are inviting everybody to join us when we are gathering in Mercy. This is a regular koha event, but we still ask you to register. On Tuesday, the 26th of June, we will have an interfaith event with the topic Abraham, a Connecting Ancestor in Faith. This is an event that is supported by the Auckland Interfaith Council. And we'll have 3 speakers, 3 keynote speakers, Father Kevin Waldie, a Bible scholar from the Roman Catholic Church, Imam Mohammed Shakir, the head of the Avondale Islamic Center, and Paul Wilton, the Jewish representative on the Auckland Interfaith Council. Please register and come along to this discussion about and learn about the other's faith. And this is in the evening, 7 to 9. On 28th of June, we will start our social justice series, 4 sessions on Thursdays from 10 o'clock to noon. You can come to all 4 sessions or choose the ones that you are most interested in. The 28th of June, we'll have People Who Made a Difference with Mary Betts. 5th of July, we'll have Paris Agreement with Sister Bridget Crisp. On the 12th of July, we'll have Catholic Social Teaching with Lynn Smith. And on the 19th of July, we'll have the Treaty Relationship with Susan Healy. For all events at our center, please register with us per phone at 09 for Auckland 638-6238 or via our website at www.mercyspiritualitycenter.org.nz. I wish you all a blessed Friday and a good week ahead. Thank you, Claire.